So yeah, Robin, I think the Parkinson-like disease, and he had a valve job, can be very depressing. His memory was going, you know, he's very physical, and his physicality was going. His career is all about, you know, his memory and his acting abilities. And so he may have just figured, you know, pain's too much. I figured the pain just got to be too much.
This is Mind Body Matters with Greg Rennie and Rob Reiford.
Welcome to our little shoe.
We got a really big shoe for you today.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many people know that one, but.
No, yeah.
Ed Sullivan, folks. And yeah. Rob and Greg doing very bad impressions again.
There we are, showing our age. If we remember Ed Sullivan, we've got to be old. Did I tell you I went to the doctor's last week and I was...
This sounds like a lead-up to a joke. Are you a joke here or something?
No. Okay. I was diagnosed...
That would be very timely, but go ahead.
Okay, I was diagnosed with OMS.
What?
I was diagnosed with OMS.
No, I heard you. I'm just going, what?
Yeah, and there's no cure. And so that, anyway, what, just thought I'd let you know.
What is OMS?
Old man syndrome.
Oh, shit. You almost had me.
Well,
people don't see it because we're audio only, but you were quite deadpan there. Oh, that was pretty good.
Okay, well, here's the deal, okay? The guy we've got on the show today, he's a very funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my attempt at comic relief or humor. And I'm not very good at it, but the guy we've got on the show today is very good at it, and I'm really looking forward to this interview.
Yeah, I think we set the trend and the contrast for his comedy because we are not comedians.
Yeah.
But the last couple episodes, as people probably have heard, you know, we've got some celebrities on there. We had an Emmy Award winning TV producer and a few other people. Who else did we have on recently? We had...
Brittle Star, Stuart Reynolds.
Right.
He was on. Brian Vollmer is on.
Right. Brian Vollmer was Helix.
That's right. And I believe that my old buddy, Jean-Marc Basapia... from The Box
is
going to be on the show probably in the next couple of weeks or thereabouts. We're trying to hammer down a date. So speaking of celebs, and this guy, he's salt of the earth. What a great guy.
You know him well. Yeah.
Yeah. I've known him for many years and just what a stand up guy and what a great musician. So I'm looking forward to that. But today on the show, you know, where there's humor, there's hope.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Where there's laughter, there's life.
I'm sorry, you're reading something.
And nobody dies laughing.
Did you just pull that out of your ass? Or where did that come
from? I actually pulled it out of our guest today, Frank King.
Frank King is on the show today. Yes, sir.
Yeah, the mental health comedian. Yeah,
I found him. Well, we were talking about this the other day, Rob. You know, I found him. I was going through some YouTube videos and looking at some comedians, and I came across a video that said mental health comedian. And I thought, how does that work? Like, what is so funny about suicide? What is so funny about mental health? So I gave this guy a listen. And I was quite impressed. And I thought, I'm going to reach out to the guy, see if he will come on the show. And sure enough, he did. He did agree. You know, I was thinking also about the episode we had with Glenn Foster, another comedian we had on the show a little while ago, when he played us that clip where there was a heckler.
I'm hoping that maybe Frank did hear that episode with Glenn Foster.
He did, actually. He did. Because before I talked to you, I had a short little chat with Frank King. And I told him about the episode, so I sent him an episode really looking forward to what his view is regarding what is funny and what is offensive. I was going through his videos, and I did some reading up on him before I talked to him. He came up the ranks in the 80s during the comic boom. So he came up with Robin Williams, Adam Sandler, Norm Macdonald. He worked with all of those guys on the way up in his career.
That's right.
And hopefully we have a chance to talk about Robin Williams, because really, when you look at talking to a mental health comedian, I mean, nothing of Robin in his later years is funny, right?
Well, unfortunately, we lost Robin years ago, and it was suicide, and we lost one of the greats. And this guy, Frank King, had the opportunity to work with Robin, plus several other people, as you mentioned. And so, yeah, I'd like to hear him talk about Robin, if at all possible, today.
Really funny guy. I got a clip I'm going to play for you here, okay?
And that's where comedy comes from. Things I think about them. I'm thinking about the oxygen mask, and I realize it is an overrated safety feature. It's a good idea on the surface. You don't have oxygen, you lose cabin pressure, you're going to be unconscious, correct. But 9 out of 10 times, why do you lose cabin pressure? Plane's going down. Seems like a darn good time to be unconscious, doesn't it? I think it's a bonus. No, man, keep them peanuts. Knock me out. You're giggling, but can you actually picture yourself, God forbid, some sort of emergency situation? You really going to reach up, grab that mask? Well, I don't want to miss a moment of this.
Yeah. Oh, he's a funny guy. And kudos to you for finding our guest today.
And another tidbit about Frank King is that he used to write for Jay Leno.
I did not know that.
I did not know that. Here we go again. Yeah. I mean,
I did not know that. Let's leave the comedic stuff up to Frank.
I think so.
Okay. All right.
Well, Frank King is in the studio today. Let's bring him in and roll tape, as we say. Do you remember that, Rob?
Roll tape.
Like we did back in the radio days, just roll tape and roll into it. Yeah. So are you a Mac guy? Are you an...
I got an iPhone and then I thought, oh, that's what this is all about.
You switched over?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how long ago?
Oh, gosh. About 2014, I think.
Would you ever go back to Android?
No, or PC. No.
Yeah. I don't know what I'm missing. I know a lot of people, you know, love Mac and love their iPhones, but I've always been Android. So what am I missing?
Well, let's see. I should move to Europe because they're big on Android and not as big on... I've got a client in Amsterdam and he goes, no, man, over here, it's Androids. I mean, iPhone is here. But
wow.
I don't know. Remember the old Blackberries? Back in the day, they would take an Apple app, Mac, you know, an iPhone app, and they would make a Blackberry version, which was never quite as good as the iPhone version, but it worked. And I waited forever. I was on T-Mobile, and they were going to merge with Sprint, and they didn't. So I had to wait another 3 years for the iPhone. They finally got the iPhone. And they were the first ones that did 25 cents a minute in 248 countries. And I was working cruises about 12 weeks a year. So, man, that was 25 cents a minute from Barbados.
Oh, my God, yeah.
They got no service here in our neighborhood in Oregon. Oregon's like a black hole for T-Mobile.
You're currently in Oregon?
Yes, and I was up on a trail half a mile from the car, had a heart attack, and I had T-Mobile, so I didn't have cell service.
Oh, my God.
Yep. So I thought, okay, not rolling those dice again.
No shit. So being Canadian, we often say Oregon, which isn't quite right, is it?
No, it's Oregon, like, well, you know, it's the United States, gun.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah,
well, and yeah. I just said to somebody yesterday from Canada, yeah, Oregon's like Canada, only more guns, worse health care.
We had another comic on a while ago. I think I sent you the episode where we were talking about Canada is that we're literally above looking down.
Yes. Yeah, there was a time when North Dakota was going to become simply Dakota. And South Dakota didn't like that. And the joke I wrote, because I was in South Dakota, oh, yeah? Oh, yeah? You got to take the North off? Why don't you just become South Saskatchewan? How about that?
Yeah. Well, we're here to talk about your speaker company.
Speaker coaching, TEDx coaching, I guess.
How did you move into this? How long have you been doing this?
Well, funny you should ask. I just told this story this morning. It was 2020. And a friend of mine also, that was March of 2020, a friend of mine and I'm sort of informal business advisor and speaker called me and said, look, I don't know how long live events, I don't know when they're going to come back. You need to lean into that coaching. So I thought, all right. So I did. Now, what I did was I've raised my fee, you know, through the years. It's now $10,000 if you want a TEDx and $10,000 if you want to make money speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all individual, 1 hour a week, no group.
And that's your current gig is mentalhealthcomedian.com, right?
Yes, mentalhealthcomedian.com. And that's a friend of mine gave me that when I said I finally figured out what I wanted to speak on because I've been a comic for 2.5 decades.
Right.
And I was speaking and I had a motivational speech and networking speech, but I wanted, you know, something where I could really teach people things and make a difference. And I decided on suicide prevention. I can tell you how I came to that conclusion. But anyway, I said, what am I going to call my company? You know, for this mental health suicide, he goes,
yeah,
you're the mental health comedian.
Yeah. Boom. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And when it comes to booking a gig, people often ask, does being a comedian keep you from getting the suicide prevention speaking gig? No. The reverse is true. They want the lived experience, which I have. They want the learning, training.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can leaven it with a little well-placed, organic, tasteful humor.
Yeah. The reason that I wanted to reach out to you is because years ago up here in Canada, we have Mood Disorders Association of Canada. And I was at this conference and they said they're going to have a speaker that's going to talk about the humor and mood disorders. And all of us were like, you know, talking with the taboo, how like this person's going to be talking about mood disorders and bipolar and all this kind of stuff. And it's going to be a comedy act, but it went over really, really well. So I'm curious if we can kind of rewind the tape from mentalhealthcomedian.com to your early days as a comic. Can we start when you were younger?
Yeah.
We talked about this on the phone, is that you grew up in a family where there was a lot of suicidality.
And humor. My sister's funny. My mom's was funny. My dad was funny. I'm funny. It's in our DNA, as is the mental illness. And by the way, cholesterol. Although I have one cousin who doesn't have high cholesterol, who doesn't have mental illness. And we all hate him with a passion. Yeah, I went to high school. I took 3 years of drama because I wanted to be an actor.
Oh.
No parts that had any speaking, no lines. I was always in the chorus. And by the second semester, last semester, senior year, I'm thinking, I see a pattern. So I thought to myself, you know what? There's a talent show coming up. And if I do stand-up, I can write, direct, and star in my own little show every night.
Right.
So I wrote a 15-minute bit. I'm sure it was horrible, but it was all about sneaking out to lunch, all the kid stuff. And nobody'd ever done stand-up at the talent show before. And then a guy, friend of mine, doing a Elton John impersonation, and then had folk dancers and a accordion player, and me doing stand-up. And man, I won. The kids went nuts. And I went home and told my mama, I'm going to be a comedian. She goes, you are going to college first. Education was big in my family. Even the women, all the women in my family were educated. I mean, going back, college educated. She goes, I don't care what you do when you get done, son. Hell, you can be a goat herder for all I care. But you're going to be a goat herder with a college degree. So I went to UNC Chapel Hill, picked up a couple degrees, political science, labor management relations, and then bolted for the West Coast. And I bolted because an insurance company that I got a job at in Raleigh, North Carolina, where I'm from, had an office in San Diego. And they moved me and my soon-to-be wife, first wife, to San Diego. And just by chance, Greg, San Diego has a branch of the Comedy Store, the world-famous one up on Sunset. Mm-hmm. It's in La Jolla on Pearl to this day. And we're talking, I've been doing it 38 years. My first open mic would have been 40 years ago, April 1st. So 40 years, same place. And I did what I recommend other people do, Greg, when they think they want to do comedy. Go to the open mic night twice. Don't go on stage. Just go and buy your ticket and go. Sit in the audience and see how bad 70% of those people suck.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I thought to myself as I'm watching them. Hell, I'm funnier than that just walking around in the daylight. So it gave me the courage, and I got on stage, and about halfway through my act, I heard a little voice in my head, you're home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And my second thought was, I'm going to do this for a living. Now, I had no idea how hard that was, Greg.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've threatened many times since then to write a keynote call. What could you do if you didn't know no better? Because I didn't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
18 months later, I said to my girlfriend, now my wife for 37 years, I'm going on the road to be a stand-up comic. Do you want to simply come along for the ride? Figuring she'd go, oh, hell no. She goes, yeah. So we gave up the apartment, gave up our jobs. I had a little tiny Dodge Colt, you know, four-cylinder, four-banger. Put everything we could fit in there, everything else in storage, took off. We didn't intend to do this, Greg, but it was a comedy boom. We had no idea that's what was happening.
What year was this around?
1984 to 1994 in the U.S. Okay. and Canada, yuck yucks and so forth, was a giant comedy boom.
Right.
They sprouted like mushrooms. And so we were on the road together with no home for 2,629 nights in a row nonstop. That's 7 years and change. And it was an amazing trip. We worked with Foxworthy and Dennis Miller and Kevin James and Adam Sandler, Rosie and Ellen.
At the height of it. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all these people that Pauly Shore, dear God, I can't unsee that.
I would love to ask you a number of questions about Pauly Shore, but we don't have time.
Yeah. Well, he came to Charlie Goodnights, which was a club in Raleigh.
Yeah. I mean, like, did he get a career because of his mom?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did he have any talent at all?
He's talented, but entitled.
Okay.
Well, I know his dad was Sammy Shore, who was a comic who opened for Sinatra. So he had the genes. And I knew his brother. I can't think of his brother's name. His sister was named Sandy. Get this. Sandy Seashore. Why would you do that to a child? It was usually sweet, not funny. But anyway, and I was there as an MC because I was working at a radio station. I did 18 months as a sidekick at the number one morning show in Raleigh.
Oh, yeah.
In 18 months, I took that number one morning show, Greg, and I drove it to number six. A friend of mine goes, you didn't drive that in the ground, man. You drove that in the middle earth. But I was MC, and Pauly was there, and his dad opened for him. So it was kind of a historical. They did five shows, sold out, so that's 1,500 people. One person called the manager of the club and said, I don't know much about comedy, but I don't believe that Shore boy has an act. And the manager, a friend of mine, Sandy DiPerna, said, sir, out of 1,500 people, you were the only one who noticed that. You can come here free any time. But it was fun. My wife and I mean, we were on the road, a Canadian, Mike McDonald.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know the name well. Yeah.
Oh, my God. One of the nicest, funniest.
Very funny.
Yeah, a little middle, but just amazingly funny. Norm McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
He got picked up by a talent agent in Canada, and they only handle headliners. And headliner means you can do 45 minutes. Well, Norm only had 30. But when they booked him in Charlie Goodnights, where I was the MC, they said, you got to do 45. So that first night, he took a really sweet 30 and turned it into a 45.
Oh, yeah.
By the time he's back the next night, he had 15 minutes for material. And did, but funny, oh, dear God.
Mm-hmm.
Quirky, nice. Now, did radio. When I got done with radio, my program director, manager said to me, you can go back and do comedy. I said, you know, the road's dying. But I was clean. So I realized I could do corporate comedy.
Yeah, you're a clean comic. You didn't use the F words and that. Yeah.
Yes, because the dirty little secret about clean comedy is it pays a whole lot better and you can do it a whole lot more places. That's not always been clean from the time I started. Jacket tie, sort of Letterman-esque.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
2007, my best year, Greg, over $200,000 telling jokes, and then the bottom dropped out. That's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like.
Mm-hmm. We talked a bit about that on the phone, yeah. Yeah.
I tell the audience, spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger.
Uh-huh.
Which begins to set them up. Wait a minute. Are we supposed to be laughing at that? At which point they realize this is different than any mental health keynote we've ever heard.
Oh, I'm sure.
My first TEDx talk. I get on stage. I said, my grandmother killed herself with an old gas stove. My great aunt with a refrigerator. What is it with my family and major appliances? I drive past Home Depot up here.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that I've seen your presentation, your material online. And I'm a therapist. Work with lots of people that struggle with deep depression. I have deep depression, past suicide attempts. And the first thing I thought of is, well, what really is funny about suicide? And you really, it's not that you walk a fine line, is that you find that part of the road that is safe enough, but taking enough risk, but also it seems like it ends up kind of being a bit of a message about it too. So what the hell is so funny about suicide?
Yeah, that's right. There's nothing funny about it. But there, you know, like many things, there are funny things. Like, I had a heart attack. I told you the audience may not hear that because you did what I do, by the way. When I was in radio, I started recording right the moment the person picked up the phone or whatever. I told you in that segment that I was out walking the dogs one morning. I was a half mile up a logging trail by myself, just me and the dogs, half mile from the car. And I've had a number of heart surgeries. Something else I inherited, a bad valve from my dad and the cholesterol of a deep fat fryer from my mother. And so half mile up that trail, I had a heart attack. And I knew it was a heart attack because it presented in the same spot that my valve issues present. You know, with the valve, if I stopped moving, the pain would ease up. But I stopped moving and the pain got worse. And I thought, oh, hell, I'm having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And as I told you off the air, I had T-Mobile, so I didn't have cell service. So I had to walk a half mile back to the car and drive 2 miles home. Now, tragedy plus time equals comedy. The longer you do comedy, the shorter the time between the tragedy and the comedy. I was doing comedy in real time, having a heart attack. I get to the hospital, and here's the best thing about a heart attack in the hospital. No waiting.
Yeah,
you go to the emergency room.
There's right to the front of the line.
Yes, you get your little triage unit. So I'm in this room, in the little room there in the bed with the, you know, and I'm in a great deal of pain as a nurse. And she says, Frank, obviously no paperwork. You're having a heart attack. But I got to ask you one question. Through the pain, Greg, I said, oh, honey, I'm married, but I do love the way you think. And she's trying not to laugh. And she goes, no. Your full name is Frank Marshall King III. But what do you like to be called? Through the pain, Greg. I said, Big Daddy. So even if you heard the expression, funny as a heart attack.
Yeah.
I was doing, and then my new cardiologist came in. I'd never met him. My old guy had moved up to Portland. We're living in Eugene. Came in, and he's from Duke University. Went to Duke Medical. Larry Southern. He goes, Mr. King? I said, yes, Dr. Gundry. By the way, they gave me some Dilaudid. Oh,
good
Christ.
Ask
for it by name.
The big D.
But he said to me, Miss Kingham, we're going to give you an angiogram. Now, Greg, I had a dozen of those already. I knew exactly, but I thought I'd have a little fun with Dr. Gundry.
Oh, no.
I said, Dr. Gundry, what's an angiogram? He said, we're going to insert, very Southern, insert a probe into a femoral artery. I said, how are we going to get it in there? He said, we're going to insert it through an opening in your groin area. I said, Dr. Gundry, as far as I know, there is only one opening in my groin area. And if you'll give me another Dilaudid in my pants back, I think I'll just stick with the heart attack. Again, Greg, now pain is gone, but I'm still having a heart attack and I'm joking with the cardiologist.
So was that like, were you trying to mask the pain by being funny or like, why did funny come up for you during that time?
Well, in part because that's the way my brain works. I tell people I can teach you to write, stand up, and perform it. I can't teach you to process the incoming information.
Yeah.
So my brain just on its own writes comedy. I mean, apparently I broke the knob off that you could turn on and off a long time ago.
But someone would say that's a coping mechanism. You know, if you're there in pain and you're in the ER, if you're joking around, then people would say, well, yeah, I mean, you're deflecting. You're coping with humor.
You know what? It's not me. I'm trying to make everybody around me comfortable.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That's what comics do.
That's a good idea because you don't want to have a surgeon, you know, cast up. So, yeah. Okay.
No. And my philosophy as a patient is to be everybody's favorite patient.
Yeah, sure.
Because you know what? They do a good job on all. But if you make an emotional connection with them, if they like you, they may pound a little harder and a little longer on your chest before they let you go. Comedy has never been self-medication for me. It's medication for others.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And then that indirectly benefits you then. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I get a little endorphin kick from it.
Going back to like what is funny with suicide, like I said, I get it. At what point did you decide to change your material and use your own experiences with suicide attempts and your family, what was that turning point where you thought, oh, this is good material?
Well, there was a turning point. And there's a woman named Jane Atkinson, wealthy speaker coach, and she wrote a book called The Turning Point, I think, or something very similar. And I have a story in there. What happened was, from the time I started comedy, Greg, I always wanted to make a living and a difference. And a difference beyond just the 45 minutes of endorphins.
Making a difference, you mean?
Making a difference, yeah. I wanted to make a living and make a difference to people.
Okay, yeah.
Beyond just the 45 minutes of endorphins, feel-good comedy, you know. But I could never figure out how or what I had to teach anybody.
Yeah.
In 95, I joined the National Speakers Association. There's a Canadian version of that. And everybody had a message. Everybody had content. And I didn't. And I was terribly jealous. So I wrote a tagline, Frank King, making a living, not a difference. Because I was militant about it. So after I came so close in 2010 to killing myself, and speaking came back, the meeting planners and speakers bureaus forced me into it. They said, look, we can't pay you $5,000 just to be funny. You got to teach our audience something. We don't care what it is, Frank, but something.
Yeah.
So I have a friend named Judy Carter. She wrote the New Comedy Bible, which is all about taking real life things that have happened to you and make them funny. Not joke writing, but your real experiences make them funny.
As they say, write what you know. Yeah.
Exactly. And so she also wrote a book called The Message of You, Turning Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. So I called Judy. I said, Judy, what am I going to teach? What do I have to share? What can I? She goes, look, let me send you a copy of my book. Read the book. You'll figure it out. So I got the book. And about halfway through, I thought, oh, hell, I do have something to talk about. Because of my, you know, my close brush with suicide. Mm-hmm. And there are more nuts in my family than in a squirrel turd. And, you know, my grandmother died by suicide. My great aunt, my mother killed herself slowly. I came that close. I have two mental illnesses, major depressive disorder, and chronic suicidal ideation. I thought I could keynote on suicide prevention if I just got some training. So the second hurdle was, Greg, I've been a comic for 2.5 decades. How am I going to convince anybody that I could do anything remotely serious? So my wife said, do a TEDx talk. And I famously said, what's a TEDx talk? Just so happens that week I got an email from a TEDx event in British Columbia, in Vancouver, BC. And so I applied. And I knew that the story of my great aunt and my mother and I finding her when I was 4 years old would turn the key. Huh. So rather than do it on Zoom, the audition, I flew up from Eugene to Vancouver to do it live.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I told them the story of my mom and I finding my great aunt. And I was 4 years old. And I mean, they were apoplectic.
Oh, yeah, I imagine.
Well, so much so that they give you 5 minutes. And they said, look, we're going to give you a signal at 4 minutes. And then, so then they started like an egg timer for 4 minutes.
Mm.
Or five minutes. They set the egg timer 5 minutes, but they said, we'll give you a warning sign at 4. So I got done, and the bell went off. And I said, was that 4 minutes? And the woman who was supposed to be giving me a signal at 4 looked really embarrassed and go, no, that was 5. They were so engrossed in the story, they forgot all about the time. They had 10 minutes worth of questions. And the reason I got it, one of the reasons besides that story, between the time I auditioned and the time of the event, Robin Williams passed away by suicide.
I like to talk about that. Yeah.
So they said to me, look, it doesn't really fit our theme, but because Robin died of suicide, if you're willing to mention Robin in your... I said, Robin's already in there. We worked together a couple of shows at the Comedy Store. Met the guy, nice guy. It's already in there. So they said, fine, you're on. So that's how I got the engagement. And by the way, it was the first weekend in October, and the last weekend in September was when I had the heart attack. And people ask me, when I'm coming down that trail, that half mile back to the car, you know, what's happening? What are you thinking? Are you seeing, you know, like a bright light? Do you hear your relatives' voices? Mm-hmm. You know, I said, I was crying. Well, why were you crying? I said, because I thought to myself, you know, if I could have just gotten to Vancouver to deliver that TEDx talk, I could have saved a lot of people, and I'm not going to make it. That's what I was crying about.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to get back to the car because we have dogs. And there's a very busy road, not 25 yards from where I park the truck. And there's logging trucks go back and forth, hell bent for leather. And so if I had not gotten the dog secured in the RAV4, then it would have ended badly for them. So I really didn't care if I lived or died as long as I got them into the car and secure. And then if I drop dead, well, they'll find the dogs. I'd be safe, you know. they'll see me, they'll notice, oh, he had a heart attack. Why didn't he call? Oh, another one with T-Mobile. So anyway, so that, yeah, that was the progression. And then after I got the first one, apparently two other TEDx events saw my first one, invited me, said, look, you got any other mental health topics? Oh, yeah. So the second and third I got by invitation. The fourth through the 10th, I applied for all of them, and I got another invitation. I have a huge footprint on LinkedIn and a TEDx in India, the state of Assam. Their version of MIT and Ivy League is IIT University. Mm. So the IIT University in the state of Assam, we love your take on mental health, Frank. Nobody else ever talks about the positive aspects. Would you do a virtual TEDx for us? Sure. So that's how I got all those. Two of them, by the way, Suicide, The Secret of My Success, Dead Man Talking.
Nice title.
Thank you. Yeah, they liked it so much, I didn't have to audition.
Yeah.
Suicide, The Secret of My Success, obviously counterintuitive. Dead Man Talking, a play on the book and movie. And that's what I tell my clients for TEDx. You have got to get their attention with a title and subtitle.
Yeah. In 2014, you had A Matter of Laugh or Death. Love that one. That's a good one. Yeah.
And the next one, number five, my favorite, again, didn't have to audition. It was Mental Health and the Orgasm. Treat your depression single-handedly. Didn't have to audition.
Yeah, but I mean, even with the title, like, wouldn't people say, okay, no, that's, you can't do that. You can't do that. That, you know, you're going to offend people, you know?
I did not get that one on my first try. 15 other TEDx committees said, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
But the executive director, the lead of the selection committee, loved it. The woman on the committee who thought the most that I shouldn't be there. I didn't know that. But she came up to me afterwards. She goes, Frank, I didn't like your idea. I didn't think you belonged here. And she said, I've never been so happy to be so wrong.
But weren't you afraid of bombing? Weren't you afraid of that? Okay, this is a good joke. I'm going to use this. Okay, this is part of my material. And then, like, didn't you have doubt and fear that it's just going to drop and people are going to look at you in the audience and go, how dare you?
How dare you? Well, you know, there are a few moments in there where that was a possibility. But my personal tagline, Greg, is often wrong, never in doubt. Because I tell my comics, when I coach comedy, I go, look, you need to tell that joke like you believe it's going to get a laugh. You can't tell it backing up, like, you know, bracing yourself for no laughter. This one and the one that follows, I thought, they may actually recoil. I said, Catholics believe that any sexual act out of wedlock that doesn't lead to the birth of a child is an inappropriate sex act. And let's face it, who knows more about inappropriate sex acts in the Catholic Church?
Ooh.
And they started laughing. I go, well, maybe the Boy Scouts. Now they're hysterical.
Oh, nice follow-up, yeah.
But I knew that that might be a bridge too far. But I wasn't leaning away from it. I was leaning into it.
Yeah.
But I knew this, it would, could be, you know.
You took the risk, yeah.
Yeah, and actually I had a parachute line if they'd gone, ooh. I go, like, I'm making this shit up. Because that's what comics get paid to do. And that's what brings me to the fella I listened to that was on your show.
Yeah, Glenn Foster, yeah.
Yeah, comics are paid to be the canary in the coal mine, to speak truth to power since the time of the court jester.
Yeah. They reflect what's there.
Yes, and oftentimes way ahead of the general population. And the example I use on interviews like this about that, in the 1950s, in the Catskills, Poconos, you know, they were joking about priests and little boys. This joke I'm about to tell you is from 1950, 46 years before the scandal broke worldwide.
Right.
How do you know when it's time to have sex in the Catholic Church? When the big hand is on the little hand. 46 years comics were ahead on that.
They told that joke in the Catskills?
In the 50s. And
wow.
10 years leading up to Harvey Weinstein getting busted,
yeah,
comics were telling jokes about his sexual predatory behavior at awards banquets and roasts. Yeah. And, I mean, that's what I think we're losing as you and... What was the comic's name that you had on?
Glenn Foster.
Yeah, Glenn.
Yeah.
That's what we're losing is comics are self-editing. And if you didn't hear the episode, she stands up and she says, you're a bigot. Yeah. I mean, not heckle.
Thank you.
You are a bigot and a lot of us are leading, so shut the fuck up.
I'm a bigot. A lot of them are leaving, so shut the fuck up. Okay. I'm a bigot?
No, you are
a comedy show. Yeah, apparently it is a comedy show. So who's unfair? Are people upset?
No.
Are we upset with this kind of bullshit that continues? That is allowed to continue because one person decides? Listen, are you offended? Let me ask you, ma'am, are you offended?
She's gone.
Oh, good. Okay. Excellent. That's how it should work. That's how society should work. It should not be like one person, well, I'm offended. Well, fuck you. No one else is. You know, we draw these lines. No, it just bothers me, you know. We draw these lines. Oh, you know, that's not funny. That's offensive. No. It's funny and offensive. So fuck off.
He said, wait a minute, you're offended. Yes. Well, is anybody else offended? And the audience, you know, you could hear they were not offended.
No, no.
And here's the social dynamic there. When he's on stage and before she does this, it's him and the audience, two separate entities. As soon as she steps up and steps in it, mm-hmm. all of a sudden it's him and the audience against her. That's the dynamic that works with heckling is in the beginning, the heckler gets shot off and he's still part of the audience. But if he or she continues and becomes disruptive, then all of a sudden the audience is on the comic side.
Yeah, the audience will turn on them, yeah.
Yeah, I've had people scream, shut up! Michael Richards, famously, the comedy club.
Oh, I know what you're going to say, that incident, yeah.
Yeah, he dropped the N-word. That was his first retort, which there was a nuclear option. There's nowhere to go. In the beginning, it's you and the audience. So when the guy fires off, you got to be gentle. Jay would always go, yeah, I'm sorry we don't have enough money for a microphone for everybody.
Rob Williams, his comeback was, I remember when I had my first beer.
Exactly.
Can we talk about Robin Williams?
Yeah, sure.
He got information that he had Parkinson's, but he was experiencing all these severe symptoms and weighed the options as people do when they're thinking of suicide. And he decided to take his life and he hanged himself. Not funny.
No.
But knowing him back then, how did his death affect the community of comedians? I mean, obviously, the day after, there are no jokes about it. Were there later on?
No. People told funny stories about things that they had done and happened when they were with him.
Yeah.
You know, it's a eulogy. There's a comic named Ollie Joe Prater. And Ollie Joe Prater was a well-known comedy thief. At his eulogy, one of the comics said, listen, I don't know a lot about etiquette, you know, Emily Post or whatever. How long do we have to wait to take our jokes back? You can joke about things that happened, about, you know, things that like that, where, and Ollie Joe is beloved. Another comic got up and said, you know, when Ollie Joe died, a little bit of every good comic died with him. So there is funny there, but it's not about, and you know, I believe Robin, and I believe in a real, also believe Robin, was living with bipolar disorder.
Yeah, yeah.
He joked about his substance abuse disorders.
Oh, yeah, alcohol and cocaine.
Yeah, treatment and recovery at length. Never a word about depression or thoughts of suicide.
No.
In part, I think, because if you're going to make a movie, the studio buys a life insurance policy on you in case you die of any cause during filming, and that way they can recover their costs. And if you tell the insurance agent you're depressed and suicidal,
mm-hmm.
you may not get the life insurance policy. And so I think that may be why he didn't, although near the end of his life, and this may have been a hint, he was on Fresh Air on NPR with Terry Gross. And somewhere in the middle of the interview, if you listen carefully, you hear him say this. You know, life's not for everybody.
Mm.
Was that a hint? Because people, 9 out of 10 people, give hints in the last couple of weeks leading up to an attempt.
Yeah.
That's what
or
I teach.
Or sometimes nothing at all. They just, you know.
Yeah, 1 out of 10, and I was one of those. I wasn't going to tell anybody. 8 out of 10 people who are suicidal are ambivalent. 9 out of 10 give hints. So if you mm-hmm. know what you look for, listen for, you can save a life. And that's what I teach. You know, you can make a difference. You can save a life. I'll show you how. So, yeah, Robin, I think it just the combination of what I believe is bipolar disorder and the Parkinson's-like disease. And he had a valve job, which can also my first valve job was heart valve job, terribly depressing. Second one, I sailed through. My wife kept waiting for the depression, and maybe the drugs got better. But it can be very depressing. And so you pile all that on top of him. And, you know, and he was losing, his memory was going.
Yeah.
You know, he's very physical, and his physicality was going. So, I mean, his career is all about, you know, his memory and his, you know, his acting abilities. And so he may have just figured, you know, pain's too much. I figure the pain just got to be too much.
And so we were talking about the other day is one of the most accurate phrases I've heard, and I wonder if you relate to it because you've made attempts before, is that the person doesn't want to die. They want to die long enough to get rid of the pain. So we understand that there must have been a lot of pain with Robin at that time, and he made that decision. Do you relate to that phrase?
Yes.
And your experiences, was that why you made the attempt? You try to use the gun?
Yes. My wife is devastated by the bankruptcy. And, you know, there's something in suicidality called burdensomeness. You feel like you're a burden to the world, to your family.
Right.
You'd be better off without you. Well, I had $1 million life insurance policy. I was literally worth more dead than alive by $1 million. So I thought I can fix this. So, that's why I was going to kill myself, to get her the $1 million. And I had sold insurance straight out of college, and I knew that almost every life insurance policy has a 2-year suicide clause. It's actually called the incontestability clause, but it has a suicide clause in it. And so I called my insurance agent. I said, how long have I had that policy? He said, 22 months, and don't do it. Because he'd had that conversation a number of times and delivered checks.
I bet.
So if I'd had that policy 24 months in a day, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Really?
And I didn't want to kill myself. There's a scene in Game of Thrones, maybe more than one, where one of the families takes somebody out to a river and they shove him underwater, essentially kill him. And then they bring him out of the water and they, I don't know, pump his chest or give him mouth to mouth and bring him back from the dead. And I thought, man, if I could do that with the depression, thoughts of suicide, if they could just kill me briefly and bring me back, yes.
Yeah. There was a statistic years ago which really impacted me as a therapist. The statistic is, and I'm not sure which bridge down the States, could have been the Brooklyn Bridge or one of those key bridges that people jumped off of, but the people that survived, they interviewed them, and they asked them that question. Did you really want to die? And I think it was like 80-85% said, no, I didn't want to die. And that they had a bit of a realization on the way down, but they wanted to die to get rid of the pain. But here's such a blatant, like, open act of jumping off a bridge. And a majority of the people didn't want to die. And that really impacted me.
Yes. And Kevin Hines, famously, Golden Gate Bridge, jumped, survived. And he knew as soon as he let go of the rail, as many people say, he knew he'd made a mistake. He lives with bipolar disorder. A voice was telling him to kill himself. He didn't know how, so he Googled it. There's a number of bridges. Which one are you closest to? Here's a map. So he got on a bus, and he thought, you know, if anybody on the bus says, are you okay? I'll tell them, no, I'm suicidal. Please call the police. I need to be taken into custody. He goes out on the bridge. He's looking over the rail. He feels a tap on his shoulder. He thinks, oh, thank God. Turns, it's a tourist. She hands him her camera, her phone, and says, would you take our picture? So he takes her picture, hands her back the phone. As soon as they turn their back, he's over the rail. Now he hits the water and then comes up, realizes he survived. Realized going, as soon as he let go, he was made a mistake. The kicker to the story is he felt something large and aquatic bump his leg under the water.
No way.
His thought was, sharks? The website didn't mention sharks. You mean I survived the drop? I'm going to get eaten by a shark? It turned out it was a sea lion. That's, you know, and there's the funny in the story. Shark.
Yeah.
They didn't mention sharks.
Yeah, they didn't make sharks, yeah.
Yeah, so there's the funny in the story. It's not the fact he jumped or was suicidal or bipolar. It's the fact he thought he'd survived and he was eaten by a shark.
Glenn Foster said, you know, the fine line is that it has to be funny, right?
Yeah.
Something that really pushes that line, and it's getting thinner and thinner as we go along, but the person takes the risk, they do the joke, and that it has to be done in a way that it's not going to tip over to offensive. There is a funny in it that saves it.
And I believe you cannot make fun of something that somebody cannot change.
Okay.
You know, if you're gay, you're gay. If you're black, you're black. If you're an idiot, you can get smarter. That's why retarded, I think, has gone away. And I think it should because, you know, if you have Down syndrome, you can't Down syndrome. Anybody here ever heard of Up syndrome? You know, it can't be something that they cannot change.
Okay.
At least that's my opinion.
Yeah.
Funny. And it has to be something that they could, you know.
Yeah.
Ron White says there's no cure for stupid. There is a cure for ignorance, though, because if you're ignorant, you can learn. Stupid, I'm sorry, it's terminal.
Are you aware of the joke that Gilbert Gottfried did at the Friars Club?
About the tsunami in Japan?
That was one thing that he lost his Geico gig for, but I believe this was before at the Friars Club. This was shortly after 9/11. And he did a 9/11 joke. And I don't want to quote it because I'm going to screw it up and I'm not a comedian, but basically it was that he was on a trip and they had a layover, in New York in reference to that. The layover was the towers, and it got one of those sounds from the audience. Ooh. And then you doubled down.
Yes. And comics often will. I told jokes cause I had to go to work the next night.
Mm-hmm.
And the elephant in the room is obviously 9/11. And I said, you know, there's nothing to joke about, but I said, I got to tell you, I have come across some funny things. I said, because here's the deal with Americans is one of our strengths is we can laugh in the face of just about anything. And I said, let me give you a couple of examples. Have you seen the meme online where it's a B-52 or it's a B-1 bomber, stealth bomber flying over, and written under the wings, it says, if you can read this, you're fucked. Yeah, and they interviewed all the governors. And the governor of Mississippi, they said, are you changing your appearance schedule? Because they still didn't know how many, if the terrorists were going to attack, where, when, whatever.
Yeah.
Have you changed your appearance schedule, you know, to avoid getting killed by terrorists? And the governor of Mississippi said, look, son, the people around me are armed. Hell, I'm armed. If they come with us, we're just going to take some of those some bitches with us. There were two or three like that. And because the tension from the event was so thick that to break it like that was like shattering glass. People wanted to laugh, but needed to figure out a way to, you know, then the Statue of Liberty, you know, Statue of Liberty, and she's got her arm raised. She's flipping the bird toward Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Those are all online within 24 hours of the attack. You know, that's how Americans deal. We don't look for the humor things, but we, you know, laugh in the face of death. You've heard it, you know, and tragedy and, you know, and you have to pick the right target.
Yeah.
And if it's a B-1 bomber with lettering under it says, if you can read this, you're fucked. You've picked the right target.
Earlier on, you talk about comedy and tragedy. You know, I like the cinematic reference like Charlie Chaplin said is that tragedy is close as a close up, and comedy is a long shot.
Yeah,
and you said something very earlier, very similar to that. What amount of time between a very very horrible event like 9/11 or Robin Williams' death is safe to make a joke? Where in hindsight, it's funny. But you wouldn't say that at the time.
No, in 9/11, I had to do something because it's a comedy show. And everybody's thinking the same thing. Everybody's wound up about 9/11. And they need to release that. You know, they call it comic relief for a reason.
Yeah.
And again, you have to pick your targets. I picked the enemy, what we thought was the enemy at the time.
Fair enough, yeah.
Yeah. And so, now there. So when I was working at the radio station, I went to an open mic. It was this 777 Japanese or a Korean one had landed in San Francisco short of the runway or something. I don't know if anybody was hurt, but the plane was certainly trashed. And so I said to the audience, how many Korean pilots does it take to land a 777? And they're looking at me like, I don't know. I said, well, apparently they don't have enough. And of course I went, what, too soon? And it was too soon for something like that.
So then, yeah, that was too soon.
Well, and also if something happens in another country, like Russia, a tragedy of some kind, then you can do it sooner than later because it happened over there.
Interesting.
Something happened here, something, you know, there's a lot of anger with 9/11. So if you can tap into that anger and angst with, like I said, pick the right enemy, pick the right story, right joke, right photograph, then it's like shattering glass.
So in 2024, are 9/11 jokes fair game?
No, I think, you know, because people jumped out of the building, it's just, it was just, again, if you, well, I take that back. There's a somebody you should go to YouTube and listen to. His name is Tim Wilson. And he said, I've got an uncle. Everybody's got an uncle like this. They were everywhere. Anything important happened. And he goes, Uncle B.S., where were you? September 11th, 2001. Let me see. You're September, you're 2011, you're 01. Ah, window washer at the Twin Towers. I'm just settling in, got my coffee. I turn around. I mean, where were you on November 23rd, 1963? Let me think. Oh, I need a job. I was working at a book depository in Dallas, Texas. So I need some help. So they hired a strange boy, Oswald.
What was the name?
Yeah. And he said he was a marksman in the Marine Corps, and I was in the, you know, I was in the Army, so I thought we should have a competition. I said, well, go get that funky rifle you bought from Italy. I bet you can't put three bullets in that manhole cover there at Dealey Plaza. And Tim got away with all that. It's a look up Uncle B.S. He was everywhere. Anything happened important, and some of them, like, he was doing 9/11 on the heels of 9/11.
But I imagine, tell me if I'm wrong, that he got away with it because the focus was on his uncle.
Yes. Again, it was his uncle who was, you know, lying about being there.
Yeah.
Yeah, not about people dying, not about planes crashing, just, you know, a window washer, Twin Towers, just for stable job. But yeah, it's Tim Wilson. If you have a chance, Uncle B.S. He was one of the most brilliant writers, bar none, of any of the people I've worked. Brilliant guy.
How can we use humor safely, without offending anybody, to get that comedy relief, to feel better? And what I understand, when you laugh, brain chemistry happens. In this year, what are ways that we can lighten up about our lives, even though we may have bipolar, we may have serious depression and think about killing themselves? I mean, what can we do to use comedy to have that relief, but also to engage those chemicals?
I'd watch late night comics, you know, the Jimmy Kimmel, Colbert, Bill Maher. Bill Maher had a great piece, better than anything I've ever seen, on the situation in Israel with Gaza. It was a rant, and he went through it historically, and also in terms of the rest of the world. You know, people have been displaced for centuries. They get displaced. That's the way it is. Yeah. They go wherever they go. They settle in. They rebuild their life. I mean, it was just, and they got attacked. Israel got attacked in 48, in 63. It was just the best summary of that situation. And he's a comic. Look at Zelensky. He played a comic on, he played a president of some country on television, I think. And he's a comedian. He's running the country and doing a pretty darn good job of holding off, you know, a superpower. Of course, now I'm sure his media skills, being a comic, you know, timing, knowing, I'm sure that came in handy. He grew up in television, so he knew how to use the medium. I would consume as much comedy as I could, and I would consume the late night comics, or, you know, find a comic you really like. I love Bill Burr.
Oh yeah,
unbelievable. The thing about Bill is, I watch him and I think it looks like he's just coming up with it off the top of his head. That's how good he is.
Yeah, damn good actor too.
Yeah, and Star Wars.
Yeah.
And in England, Jimmy Carr.
Yes.
Filthy, but brilliant. Little baby face, crazy laugh, but just, you know, because I'm in Germany. And my German friend says, I can't get good bagels here. And Jimmy goes, yeah, and whose fault is that?
Should I laugh? I am.
We were laughing about the Holocaust right there.
Yeah.
But see,
absolutely,
the way Jimmy framed it, you know, he makes the guy he's talking to the dick.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Even though I was laughing, part of me, you know, should I be laughing? Yeah.
I say to the audience, when I say I put a gun in my mouth and I say, spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger. I go, look, it's okay to laugh. That was the point.
Yes. Let's talk about your coaching. So mentalhealthcomedian.com, is that to coach and help people become speakers or comedians?
No. I have another website, howtomakemoneyspeaking.com.
Okay, so that's separate.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I'm a big believer in separating the things. If you go to my LinkedIn profile, all you'll see is how to make money speaking. You'll see a couple of TED Talks, but nothing about suicide prevention speaking. And if you go to my coaching, my how to make money speaking, you won't see anything about suicide. So I keep the two.
Okay.
Because the confused mind can't make a decision. I think if you're a speaker, you need to pick a lane and that's all you do.
Right, right.
And if you're a coach, that's all you do. Or at least it appears that way.
So when we were putting this together, I asked what you wanted to talk about, at the end to promote, and you said mentalhealthcomedian.com. What would you like listeners to know about mentalhealthcomedian.com?
Well, that 8 out of 10 people who are suicidal are ambivalent, 9 out of 10 give hints in the last week leading up to an attempt, which means you can make a difference, you can save a life, and you can do it by doing something as simple as we're doing right here, and have the courage to start a conversation, if you know how, and I tell the audience, and I'll teach you how. So it's a matter of, simply, if you thought somebody was suicidal, if you just flat say to them, are you having thoughts of suicide? It actually lowers the risk that they will, in fact, take their lives, which
Absolutely.
Is the reverse of what most people think.
Yeah. Share the story that you shared with me that this thing happened. We were on stage and you interacted with someone, and afterwards, I believe it was a construction worker, afterwards you realized that actually you made a difference by saying what you said. Can you share that?
Yeah, I believe, as Brené Brown believes, that vulnerability is a superpower, especially among men. Men don't usually talk about this. So see me on stage, obviously high functioning, but, nuttier than a squirrel turd, sharing my story, getting a little choked up as I do. I was at a construction site in Cincinnati, and I do a little general Q&A at the end. And then I say, look, if you got a question you want to ask or a story you want to share and you don't want to share it with everybody, I'll hang out another 30, 45 minutes and we'll take them individually. So as often happens, there was half dozen people lined up, guys, which is unusual, men.
Mm-hmm.
Last guy in line was a nice young African-American gentleman, probably mid-20s. He's crying so hard he can't speak. So I wait. And he gathers himself. I said, what's wrong, man? He goes, I haven't slept for 2 nights. I work on the 5th floor of this building. I think about jumping off every day. I said, well, why is that? He said, because in the last year, I've lost 3 people close to me to violence, including my daughter who died in my arms. And I knew the HR guy was standing. I knew who the HR guy, human resources guy was. He was standing out to cry, and I waved him over. And I said, look, you need to take this young man by the hand. You need to go find the Employee Assistance Program binder and find a mental health facility and get him there right this minute simply for evaluation because he's circling the drain.
Right. Yeah.
And I called up the meeting planner a couple of months later on another issue. And I was terrified to ask, but I finally got up my courage and said, whatever happened to a nice young man? Frankie got evaluated, Medicaid, and back on the job. I'm guessing he probably had never told his workmates that story. He might have not even told some of his family that story, but he felt comfortable enough after watching me speak, listening. Yeah, here's the deal. And Brené Brown said this. I've said it a number of different ways, but she said it the best, I think. Is I come across like this. I am so comfortable in my darkness, I can sit with you comfortably in yours.
Wow.
And that's the superpower, I think.
I've never heard that before. My God. What a way to wrap this up.
Yeah, how's that for a closer?
Did you save that for the end just to kind of, close it up and get an applause? Or
no,
That was great.
It just occurred to me. Here's how I normally close. I say to the podcaster, can I close this out for you? Oh, sure, try, Frank. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate, subscribe, and review. And tell your friends. If you did not enjoy the podcast, well, we hope you have no friends. That's my usual closer.
Well, I'm going to challenge you with a variation of that when we really do close, but I want to go to a quote first. So think some time to kind of think about how the variation of that. So the quote you gave me, and this is how I usually end the show, is this is from Arthur Block. This is what you sent to me a little while ago. Friends come and go, but enemies accumulate. Why did you choose that one? Why do you like that one?
Well, I was reminded of it at the gym the other day. I was in gym, I was lifting because of body build. And I got off the elliptical runner and I'm headed for the weights. And some guy yells at me, "Hey, you didn't wipe down your elliptical right. runner. Why didn't you wipe it down?" I said, "Because I don't work here." And kept moving. Well, he went and told the guy at the front desk, pointing me out. And I asked the guy at the front desk, "Is it a rule? I got to wipe it down?" He goes, "No, but I'd appreciate it." I go, "Fine, I'll wipe it down. I just didn't know." So, but now I've made an enemy. So the next day I'm in the gym, and lo and behold, the guy that I had the kerfuffle with is standing next to one of my friends from the bodybuilding contest. So I walked right up to the guy I knew and said, "Mike, would you tell this nice gentleman that I'm not a dick?" And they both started laughing. And he goes, "I didn't call you a dick." I said, "I know you called me a mother, whatever." But that's a fine point. Anyway, I made him laugh.
Yeah.
And Mike unknowingly managed the detente. I saw an opportunity where I have a friend and somebody doesn't like me and I can leverage that.
Yeah.
And Mike goes, "He's not a dick." And then after I got done on the elliptical that day, they were still in the gym. So I walked right up to his name, Brad. I go, "Brad, two things. I wiped it down. Not only did I wipe it down, it is as clean as a surgical suite. And B, I believe we should be friends because friends come and go, but enemies accumulate." Big laugh. So now I've made a friend. So I have philosophy to live by. Yeah, he was mean. I was mean. And I apologize for responding the way I did. I should have said, "Oh man, I'll go back and do it."
Yeah.
But I was just.
But you didn't know. Yeah, you didn't know. He thought you knew,
He thought I knew. He thought I was just being, but I was able to turn the whole thing. And there's a psychological principle there. I imagine you know of it. Is if somebody doesn't like you in the beginning and they grow to like you, they like you more because they have to convince themselves to like you.
Yeah.
So I think I've made a friend and a big one. He's twice my size. So, I thought for sure he's going to come in and confront me or, he doesn't know I'm suicidal and I'm not scared to die. Yeah, I don't want to, but I'm not scared of it.
Well, this discussion that we've had, Frank, I was looking forward to it because I wanted to look at it from my lens as a psychotherapist and also my lens as a fan of comedy. So this has been fascinating for me. I hope the listeners, I do know the listeners would have found it very interesting, very funny, and a perspective on mental health and as we talked, what is funny, what is offensive. It was all a great discussion. How would you end this today?
Another favorite quote from many a comedian. "Thank you very much. That's my time. Do me a favor. Tip your waitress. One of them is carrying my child."
Excellent. Thanks, Frank.
Yeah, Greg, my pleasure.
Thanks again.
Yeah, man.
And there you have it, our interview with Frank King. What a funny guy.
Very funny guy. Now, you usually ask me, Rob, what's your takeaway from all this?
What's your takeaway from all of this?
Well, I think the funniest thing, and there were a lot of funny moments today in the interview, but I still like the idea of nuttier than a squirrel turd.
Yeah, that might be in my vernacular from now on.
That's right. I think he used that a couple of times throughout the day, but no, very funny guy, Frank King. And by the way, I want to make mention of this too. Being a guy who has, I never tried to commit suicide, but I had a son.
I did. I've attempted suicide.
But, as I'm listening to you guys talk today, I'm going, okay, is there a right time or is there not a right time for comedy? And I do believe this. I mentioned off the top, where there's humor, there's hope. Where there's laughter, there's life. And nobody dies laughing. And as I'm listening to you guys today, having gone through with what I've gone through over the last little while, I didn't find any of this offensive at all today.
Oh, good. Yeah.
No, not at all. And the ability to talk about this quite openly, as Frank King does, I think is great. And I think that's his mission. You know, he's talking about mental health. He's talking about suicide. Oh, and it got me. You guys were talking about people, jumping off the bridge.
It got pretty serious after a while. Yeah,
it did. And not to mention the Robin Williams.
Yes.
And I mean, oh, God, do I ever miss Robin Williams?
Oh, don't get me started. Oh, man. I still can't watch his movies.
Really?
Yeah.
I watched Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Not too long ago. And just because I wanted to laugh.
Was this during your loss?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. So when you're...
Because it was one of...
Your son's suicide, yeah.
Yeah, and it was one of our favorite shows. I would sit down regularly with my two sons, Alex and Andrew. Okay. And we used to watch Mrs. Doubtfire, and we just used to laugh.
What's therapeutic, right? What's therapeutic about laughing during a really difficult time? I mean, he's able to bring it into context, and I was surprised, you know, talking with him how he can do this. But for you, was that therapeutic, or was that reminiscing of watching that movie again sad for you?
It was just remembering how much of a great comedian, actor Robin Williams was, and some of the laughs that I had watching that movie years ago with my kids. And I think that was the reason I wanted to go back there and relive those moments when my kids were youngsters. And so that's why I watched that movie. An amazing, amazing comedian, started way back with what was Mork and Mindy. Uh-huh. And then he did so many roles, Mrs. Doubtfire, the list goes on and on of the movies we had the pleasure of seeing with Robin Williams in them. And I thought he was genius.
Yeah, I think there'll be a time where I'll be able to watch his movies again. But yeah, I'm still sad over that suicide. I mean, I did not see that coming. And it hurt me that such a brilliant guy, and I know it's been said many, many times, he was a comic genius. But I think if the definition is there, the definition is there, and it's under his name. But, such a tragedy. And speaking of, tragedy, I think it's kind of cool that Frank and I were able to talk about some pretty serious tragedies. And then he brought in some jokes that he knows, but I brought up with him the whole thing of Gilbert Gottfried. And I was watching that not too long ago. And yeah. I thought, wow, that was too soon. But it's funny because that video is old that I was watching.
You got talking to about how early.
What's the amount of time? Because, comedy comes from tragedy. In a long shot, as I said, in time. But what is that amount of time?
Well, here's the thing, and it takes me back. You talked about 9/11 today.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, do you remember after 9/11, all the comedy shows, the late night comedy shows, so the Lettermans, the Lenos, they didn't do their show for a long period of time because I guess you've got to take the time to mourn, to, just take the time for what happened. And it wasn't, if my memory serves me correct, it wasn't 1 or 2 weeks, and it was then the late night talk shows came back on the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first show back with David Letterman, and it was one of my favorite shows. Yeah.
I remember Saturday Night Live, where they had Paul Simon come on, and then I think Giuliani was there. He was mayor at the time, and I remember Lorne Michaels asking him, "Can we laugh again?" And Giuliani says, "Yeah, I think we need to have laughter." And then they went on with the show, but that was not too far after 9/11.
I think we titled that episode that we did months back with Glenn Foster, we called it
Funny or Offensive.
Or was it laughter is the best medicine?
We also talked about that, too. Yeah.
And so I want to make that point, too, with Frank King. I mean, we have to laugh, Greg. Like, when you look at how screwed up this damn world is, you know, we need laughter. And even if the subject matter is suicide, it's still bringing awareness to mental health. And I think that's very important.
Yeah, it's quite amazing how he's able to, you know, weave humor into it. But I, you know, I get it. And that's why I pursued him and asked if he could be on the show, because I have a dark sense of humor that has helped me over the years. And I grew up with a family where we had dark humor. So when he said,
So did I.
Yeah. It's healing. But the one bit he had about, which is a true story, is that he was thinking of killing himself. So he had a gun pointed at himself, and he, in the act, I believe I'm going to paraphrase, because he's a comedian, I'm not, but he said that I know what the taste of gunmetal is in my mouth, because I had a gun to my head,
right?
But spoiler alert, I didn't pull the trigger.
And that was funny. I said, I was downing some coffee at the time.
Oh no!
And he said, spoiler alert. I nearly upchucked my coffee at that point. Like spewed it all over the place because I laughed so hard.
Yeah. Well, Frank, thanks so much for being on the show and helping us understand that there is laughter, there is comedy within tragedy, there is a way to laugh and heal, even though you're going through some very, very difficult times, as you did, Rob, you know, with your son. Next week, we have another episode of Keep Talking. I think I know who's going to be on the show. I think we know what we're going to talk about, but we're not going to quite say yet, right?
Okay. Yeah, we'll keep it a secret.
Keep it a secret,
but I'm actually looking forward to, I look forward to every week here on Mind Body Matters, but this is going to be one interview I've been looking forward to doing for a long time. You know, if the planets align and we don't run out of time, we will have this certain person on the show next week here on Mind Body Matters. But until then,
be kind to yourself.
And most importantly, be well.
Be sure to like and follow us on all social media. And if you like what you hear, hit subscribe, download, and share with your friends. Mind Body Matters is a Great Media production.